two biggest rivals, and now we're looking at the prospect of the two countries being drawn even closer together, given their shared outrage.
India feels regional pressure on Kashmir. It's Monday, August 12th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Hong Kong protests and clashes continue. Rohingya are identified. Global reaction to U.S. mass shootings. President Trump reacts too. Dire predictions of climate change. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Authorities in Indian-administered Kashmir say they have eased restrictions in most parts of Srinagar, the main city, ahead of an Islamic festival following India's decision to strip the region of its constitutional autonomy. The local magistrate in a tweet said that more than 250 ATMs have been made functional and bank branches open for people to withdraw money ahead of today's Eid al-Adha festival. There was no immediate independent confirmation of reports by authorities that people were visiting shopping areas for festival purchases because all communications and the internet remained cut off for a seventh day. Authorities appear to be acting with utmost caution because of a fear of a backlash from residents who have been forced to stay indoors since last Monday. India's main opposition Congress Party leader, Rahul Gandhi, said Sunday that there are reports of violence and people dying in the region. Authorities in Srinagar said there have been instances of stone pelting by protesters, but no gun firing by security forces in the past 6 days. Television images showed movement of cars and people in some parts of Kashmir. State-run All India Radio quoted the region's top bureaucrat as saying that people were coming out of their homes for Eid shopping. Regional neighbors, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and China have become increasingly concerned by India's move in Kashmir. VOA Asia's Ira Melman explored more with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center for Scholars here in Washington.
I think it's important to look at what's happened in Kashmir against the backdrop of a rapidly progressing peace process in Afghanistan. So what you have in Afghanistan is the U.S. and the Taliban have had a series of talks, and they are reportedly getting close to a deal. And that will bring the process closer to a situation where you could have serious negotiations on a comprehensive political settlement. And if there is a political settlement, it would result in a government in Afghanistan where the Taliban has a prominent role. So bottom line here, as the peace process intensifies and gains momentum in Afghanistan, we're getting closer to the day where the Taliban could have power, or could have a position in power, and that is very alarming to India. It is a very good thing for Pakistan, because that's what Pakistan has always wanted in Afghanistan, is a pro-Pakistan government, and one with the Taliban as a part of the government would presumably be pro-Pakistan and anti-India. So I do think that one of the potential factors that could have led to India making its move on Kashmir when it did is to try to push back against Pakistan, which has had its hand strengthened in Afghanistan as these peace talks have proceeded in ways that Pakistan would like them to go. So I think that India, you know, you could argue, is sending a message to Pakistan that it continues to have regional clout and it will push back in ways that it can, such as in Kashmir, if it thinks that Pakistan is making progress and enjoying geopolitical victories in Afghanistan.
Given your theory as truth, does this not belie everything Pakistan has recently been saying about it not joining up with such insurgent groups?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's clear that for Pakistan, you could discuss the extent of its ties to insurgent groups, but I think that the ultimate goal for Pakistan and Afghanistan. The ultimate goal for Pakistan and Afghanistan is to have a government that is friendly to Pakistan. And, you know, given what the options are, that would logically be a government that has some sort of Taliban role. And so the Pakistanis would want to do everything they can to make sure the Taliban would stay friendly with them and want to work with them to get to a position where the Taliban would be in a position of power and would stay friendly with Pakistan. So they're clearly, the ties between the Pakistanis and the Taliban are still very much there, but the Pakistanis don't just provide support to the Taliban as an end in and of itself. It wants to help the Taliban to be in a position where it could be influential and have power. And again, thanks to this peace process playing out, looks like we're moving closer to where that could become a reality.
China seems to be quite unhappy that they share a border with Kashmir and with what India has done. What do you say about that, and what's to come of that, if anything?
Yeah, well, it's important to remember that China was actually directly affected by Pakistan's, by India's decision to change the status of Kashmir. You know, we talk so much about Jammu and Kashmir and Pakistan's claim on that and so the implications of India's move for Pakistan, but India also decided to change the status of Ladakh, which is another region to which China has long had a claim. So I would argue that China is actually more directly affected by this Indian move than any country other than Pakistan. China issued a very strongly worded condemnation of India's move the other day. As I recall, it described India's move as unjustifiable and void. Those are some pretty strong terms right there. Now, the question is, what does China actually do? I mean, ultimately, there's not much it can do. The deed is done. India is not going to reverse its decision. But I do think this means that China could move even closer to its ally Pakistan than it already was. And that does not work to the best of India's interests, because, you know, Pakistan and China are India's two biggest rivals. And now we're looking at the prospect of the two countries being drawn even closer together, given their shared outrage at what they perceive to be a unilateral move by India to formally incorporate territory into their union, so to speak, that both Pakistan and China have long claimed. So that's sort of, I think, the negative consequence for India in that regard. But again, I'm not sure what China will actually do. I mean, there's not much it can do. I'll issue some angry statements and things like that.
Well, China moving even closer to Pakistan, which, as you just said, is a continuation of what has been happening on the international global scene. What does that do as far as the United States is concerned?
Well, you know, I think the United States has designated China as not only its top strategic competitor, but also as a national security threat. I mean, it had a national security strategy that it released in 2017 in which it said that strategic rivalry is the top U.S. National security threat. So that basically means China is a national security threat. So anything that China does is going to be a concern for the United States. And clearly it sees that China has been doing so much on the world stage, motivated in great part by its Belt and Road Initiative, this huge transport corridor infrastructure project meant to deepen its influence around the world. And, you know, I imagine the U.S. is none too happy that so much of these activities are occurring in parts of the world, including in South Asia, where the U.S. is less present and less popular. And that particularly applies to the case of Pakistan, where China has this China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, the Pakistan dimension of the Belt and Road Initiative, which continues to develop. You know, that's concerning for the U.S. The U.S. will fear that China will try to, you know, take these investments and somehow derive some military use out of them, such as basing naval vessels in a port off Pakistan that is developing as part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. So, yeah, I think that, you know, the U.S. will always worry about what China is up to, and particularly this Trump administration, which has taken a pretty maximalist, hawkish, one could argue, alarmist view toward China.
Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center for Scholars in Washington. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you make a visit to voanews.com. Hong Kong police fire tear gas amid continuing pro-democracy rallies. Typhoon leaves 28 dead in China, 20 still missing. India flood toll jumps to 144 as roads, highways cut off. Myanmar battles rising floodwaters after landslide kills 52. Press groups say regulations and violence constrain Indonesia's journalists. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and so much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hong Kong police fired tear gas at protesters Sunday who staged demonstrations in two locations in the territory, the Sham Shui Po area and a main shopping district in the Causeway Bay area. This weekend's round of pro-democracy rallies marks the 10th straight weekend for the demonstrations. Chinese officials are upset that British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab had a telephone conversation with Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam on Friday about the demonstrations. A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman said China demanded that the British side immediately stop all actions that meddle in Hong Kong affairs and, quote, interfere in China's internal affairs. On Saturday, thousands of residents, furious with government indifference and harsh policing, fought battles throughout the city as they tried frenzied urban guerrilla tactics to block roads, occupy the airport terminal, march en masse, and participants shrugging off rounds of tear gas. Protesters staged the flash protests in lieu of organized legal marches after police took the highly unusual step of denying permits, saying that they would invite violence. Protesters say they will continue with such provocative actions because it was proving effective in rattling the government and winning support of Hong Kong residents. Under pressure from millions of residents, Carrie Lam agreed to shelve but not kill the controversial extradition bill that sparked initial protests. Hong Kong officials have refused to concede any demands made by the protesters, including the creation of an independent commission into police actions against protesters and the full withdrawal of the extradition plan. Our thanks to Suzanne Settelain in Hong Kong for passing along the latest developments. Happening now in Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump has said for weeks he has no problem with North Korea testing short-range missiles, insisting they are not a threat to the United States. North Korean state media Sunday cited Trump's comments hours after rolling out what appears to be yet another new short-range missile system. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today as we begin a brand new week on VOA Asia. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than a half million Rohingya refugees living in Bangladesh have received identity documents that will give them better access to aid. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
An estimated 900,000 Rohingya refugees are living in overcrowded, squalid camps in the town of Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. Most of them fled there 2 years ago to escape persecution and violence in Myanmar. A joint registration project by Bangladeshi authorities and the UN Refugee Agency will give identity documents to more than 500,000 of the refugees, many for the first time. The data on these fraud-proof biometric cards will give national authorities and humanitarian partners a better understanding of the population and its needs. UNHCR spokesman Andrei Mihecic tells VOA the data collected will allow aid agencies to better help people with specific needs.
The point of the verification exercise of conducting a biometrics data registration is first and foremost to protect the right of the Rohingya refugees to return to their homes. It is meant to ensure far better planning and far better targeting of the assistance of very specific types of assistance that, for example, women would need, that children would need.
Mihecic explains the new registration cards indicate Myanmar is the country of origin. He says that information is critical in establishing and safeguarding the right of Rohingya refugees to return to their homes in Myanmar if and when they decide to do so. The UNHCR and other humanitarian agencies say they do not believe conditions in Myanmar currently are safe enough for the refugees to return home. The registration process began in June 2018. On average, some 5,000 refugees are being registered every day. The UNHCR says it aims to complete biometric registrations and provide identification documents for the remaining 400,000 people in Cox's Bazar by the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, growing concern and initial responses to recent U.S. gun violence. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. The death toll from a powerful typhoon that hit southeastern China rose to 33 Sunday as rescue workers used rubber dinghies to rescue stranded people as swift currents swept by homes. China's emergency broadcasting network said 16 people were still missing in Zhejiang province. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for these and more stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, for many years, the United States has been issuing advisories, warning potential travelers about countries plagued by terrorism or armed conflict. But now, Amnesty International, Japan, Uruguay, and other countries are warning about the danger of travel to the United States, citing gun violence. President Donald Trump says he will take aim at specific countries issuing such warnings, as VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
A spate of mass shootings within days at a garlic festival in California, a Walmart in El Paso, and a popular neighborhood in Dayton, Ohio, have Americans on edge. The human rights organization Amnesty International, Japan, Uruguay, and other nations are warning their citizens about travel to the United States because of gun violence. The warnings annoyed President Trump.
Well, I can't imagine that, but if they did that, we'd just reciprocate. We are a very reciprocal nation with me as the head. When somebody does something negative to us in terms of a country, we do it to them.
Citing the 2015 shooting at a Bible study in Charleston, South Carolina, and others, the Amnesty warning calls attention, in its words, to the extent to which all aspects of life in the United States have been compromised in some way by unfettered access to guns.
That individuals going to church, as in South Carolina, and going to prayer service and Bible study, it ends in folks getting shot and killed. As we saw last week or week before last at the Garlic Festival, which is a normal yearly event. Individuals go to have fun and spend family time. That has been damaged, and now is not a place that folks can go to, as well as Walmart shopping.
Other experts point to the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, saying the U.S. is unique in its guaranteeing the right to bear firearms.
It's hard sometimes for the international community to understand how different the conversation is in America because of the Second Amendment and because of our long history of civilian ownership of guns.
But increasingly, Americans are calling on their political leaders to protect them from gun violence. Close to 40,000 Americans are killed by firearms each year, and a majority of the deaths are suicides. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
This news from VOA Asia. Myanmar troops and emergency responders scrambled to provide aid in flood-hit parts of the country Sunday after rising waters forced residents to flee by boat and a landslide killed at least 52 people. The season's deluge has tested disaster response after that fatal landslide Friday. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump has responded to recent mass shootings by pushing for a renewed focus on mental illness as a major cause of gun violence. VOA's Brian Padden reports while the president has called for more treatment and involuntary detention of mentally disturbed individuals, his administration has rolled back federal regulations to restrict the mentally ill from buying guns and has tried to abolish a health care law that expanded across to mental health services in the United States.
More than 31 people were killed in the two mass shootings last week in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, by gunmen armed with assault rifles. Responding to public outcries, President Trump promised action to stop the carnage, but he downplayed the need for aggressive gun control and instead urged the focus on mental illness in America.
Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun.
The president called for reforming mental health laws to better identify violence-prone individuals and mandate treatment, but also, when necessary, involuntary confinement. However, gun control advocates and health professionals say it would be ineffective to focus primarily on mental illness, including depression and anxiety that affect one in five adults. Instead, experts say past violent behavior is the best threat indicator.
What we know is that hate is driving these crimes, and hate is not a mental illness.
Critics also said the president's rhetoric does not match his actions. The administration rolled back past regulations restricting gun ownership to the mentally ill and has tried to eliminate the Affordable Care Act, former President Barack Obama's signature health care law, which expanded access to private medical insurance and also expanded a government program that covers mental health treatment for low-income individuals.
Certainly, mental health services matter, but the same people that say it's mental health that's not too many guns on the street are the same people that try to cut Medicaid and the same people that try to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
The focus on mental illness, gun control advocates say, also ignores other factors such as Americans' easy access to firearms, including high-capacity assault rifles.
But if you want to do something about gun violence, you need to do something about guns.
President Trump has voiced support for strengthening background checks for gun purchases, but opposition from gun rights groups as well as a politically divided Congress dim prospects for such legislation to become law. If sweeping federal action is unlikely, individual U.S. states could take the lead. 17 states have initiated extreme risk protection orders known as red flag laws that allow authorities to take guns away from people deemed to pose a danger to themselves and others. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations says climate change is about to hit the world in the stomach. A new scientific report from the world body that examines land degradation concludes that climate change will imperil crops and worsen hunger. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
Historically high temperatures recently caused the largest monthly melt-off of ice in Greenland, an ominous foreshadowing of rising sea levels. A UN study warns that in coming years, climate change also may affect what and how much we have to eat.
Despite increasing food production, an estimated 821 million people are undernourished. In general, climate change will cause declined yields, increased prices, reduced nutrition levels, and disruption in supply chains for food.
Scientists at the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change say that man-made factors challenge the world's fragile ecosystems.
Increasing impacts on land are projected in the future as a result of water scarcity, wildfire, and permafrost thawing. In a warmer climate, the capacity of the land to store the carbon may be reduced.
The panelists are urging an international effort to combat climate change.
Limiting global warming to 1.5 or even 2 degrees will involve removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and land has a critical role to play in carbon dioxide removal.
Scientists say reducing food waste and diversifying agriculture can help blunt the impact.
25 to 30% of food produced is lost or wasted. And reducing food loss and waste can reduce pressure on land, improve food security, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, a move to more balanced diets could help us adapt to and limit climate change.
While not explicitly telling people what to eat, the panel says reducing red meat consumption in favor of plant-based foods could drop as much as 15% from current greenhouse gas emission levels by mid-century. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, this is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud, of course on VOA Asia Facebook, and voanews.com, our website. You can also write to us. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. And check out our new YouTube channel at VOA Asia. We'd love for you to subscribe and see all the videos we've posted. You can also hear us on the radio, CCU Radio, at National Chung-Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. Hello to everyone there who is listening to our program today. Thanks for joining us. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Aiden Utku, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
China is chief among countries that fail to recognize the crucial nature of religious freedom, said Chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, or USERF, Dr. Tenzin Dorji.
In China, you know, they put all the restrictions you can ever imagine on all religious minorities, whether these are Muslims from Xinjiang, Uyghurs, or the Tibetan Buddhists in Tibet, or the Christians, or the Falun Gong, and others.
USERF monitors religious freedom abroad and makes policy recommendations to the President of the United States. As part of its commission's Religious Prisoners of Conscience project, which highlights individuals imprisoned for exercising their freedom of religion or belief, each of the 10 commissioners advocates for specific individuals targeted for their faith. Both of Dr. Dorji's prisoners of conscience are victims of China's draconian policies. Gulmira Ayman, a Uyghur Muslim and former web administrator for the Uyghur language website Salkin, was accused by the Chinese government of organizing protests and leaking state secrets by phone to her husband in Norway. On April 1, 2010, she was sentenced to life in prison. Dr. Dorji also sponsors the 11th Panchen Lama. After the 10th Panchen Lama died under mysterious circumstances in China, the Dalai Lama in 1995 recognized then 6-year-old Gedun Choki Nima as the 11th Panchen Lama. 3 days later, the boy and his family were abducted, said Dr. Dorji.
Chinese knew that Dalai Lama is in advanced age. When he passes away, usually the Panchen Lama would be much older, and he would play a key role in finding and recognizing him. And so they abducted the real Panchen Lama and family, and then they appointed their own candidate called Tenzin Norbu and groomed him as the real Panchen Lama and showcased across the world.
Dr. Dorji said that the Chinese government responds with shallow platitudes to the commission's inquiries regarding Gedun Choki Nima. China has declared war on faith, said Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom Samuel Brownback. And to this we say to China, do not be mistaken. You will not win your war on faith. This will have consequences on your standing at home and around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.